Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And now that I've said CIUT, it's my opportunity to start by reminding everybody next week is a big moment because we're going to be fundraising for the station. And it's the approaching 35th anniversary, big stuff. And Tater Report, and certainly I have been a part of the story for quite a time and a bunch of wonderful people, and you know, does wonderful programming. So we'll be asking you to donate, and that would be, we officially launches on the 9th, but what the heck, you can start right now. You can go to CIUT.fm and hit the donate button and be kind enough to mention the Tater Report. Listeners will know that we are in no way officially in any other way associated with the Cold War. We don't approve of it. We're not exactly excited or enthusiastic about NATO. Let me put it another way. NATO has been a curse, depriving Canadians of our autonomy and independence. It's a collection of states that used to be have voices of their own, but they all defer to somebody who, as I understand, is about to become a banker in Belgium or Switzerland or some such place. He does all of our talking for Canada. And what's Canada? What's the budget going to be? What percentage will go to the military? That depends on what Mr. Stoltenberg announces officially. I assume Canada is at the meeting and is awake when the decision is made, what type of weapons will be purchased, where personnel will be distributed. All that is, there's a kind of an omerta factor. They go to the meetings and they decide. So in other words, Tater Report really wishes and actually insists that we rethink this whole situation because we are, as periodically happens, drifting into dangerous waters where the big decision makers, our president, Joe Biden, and our, actually, what is Nancy Pelosi? Speaker of the House. Our Canada's Speaker of the House are really becoming more and more passionate and dangerous and talking irresponsibly. And this is what should give Canadians pause. And because the second matter after, you know, NATO and not being Cold War is, since we're in a crisis, show up frequently in life. This one is now labeled by the Toronto Star of Sunday, the 1st of May. They said that somebody ought to be thinking about how we're going to extricate ourselves from the situation. That was the last sentence of an otherwise worthless editorial. But the sentiment was good. It says, the danger is that we may find ourselves on that road without really quite realizing, while there is still time, the world needs to find a way before we got to the brink. And as a matter of fact, I would add again, the reason we do the program, talk about these issues, is that the editorial is, while it's titled Edging Toward a Wider War, the last paragraph said they'd rather not. Well, that means you have to speak up. If you remember NATO, you really aren't, it won't be appreciated. But you ought to do it. Canada should find its voice, and its voice shouldn't really come out of Nancy Pelosi, or Canada's voice shouldn't come out of our president, Joe Biden. It ought to really find itself as a result of actual discussions among Canadians, amongst organized labor, amongst new Canadians, amongst Indigenous Canadians, French Canadians, all who put their labor and hopes into this country need to be fighting to have some type of healthy exchange, because unanimity, particularly for a stupid cause, is the last thing we need. And that unanimity that Parliament has just voted unanimous, all parties led by the NDP voted unanimously to label Russia, the Security Council member, permanent member of the Security Council, one of the victors, our ally in the destruction of Nazism, fascism. It was on the 29th of April, 45, that the Soviet flag was raised over the Reichstag, which no one here wants to remember. So that country, which gave the most in terms of life and treasure in the destruction of Nazism, that country, was labeled by the Canadian Parliament unanimously as guilty of genocide. So the Toronto Star celebrates both things, I guess. They thought that were wonderful, I suppose. Of course, it's disastrous if you're to take it seriously. It means that they've lost their minds collectively, and they have, but this is the most extreme type of language. And to be introduced in something resembling a parliament without any actual debate or discussion, and to utter it like that is to say that there isn't any hope for peace, actually. It means an investment in a dumb idea, which is we're going to go for victory in the current crisis around Ukraine, Russia. Going to go for victory, going to say things which, I think it was Carl Sandburg says, be careful how you use harsh words. They wear long boots, hard boots. They can't hear you calling them to come back. Once you say them, you may regret it. We underline these kind of things at the Taylor Report. We advise political leaders, moderate their tone, be careful what they say. Be, what's the word, statesmanlike. Show a little worldliness, that you've been around the block, you've seen a few wars, you've been through some things. You don't just carelessly throw words around because you've been to a party last night and just now you feel like really tying one on here. No, this is not what we need. Underlining that, I guess we have to add, I may as well join in the group everybody is discussing. There, the Rear Admiral John Kirby, he's not always called that. Rear Admiral, don't ask. Rear Admiral John Kirby of the United States Navy, who is the Pentagon spokesperson, had a kind of a breakdown on doing his press statement on behalf of the Pentagon. So here's a guy who's a Rear Admiral, and he said that he, seeing the pictures of the crisis, you know, something to do with Ukraine, that the level of, I think he said, depravity shook him, and he became at a loss for words, and his eyes roamed around the room, and reporters leaned forward anxiously, wondering if he's going to put his head on the table and weep, I guess. If he was in the United States Navy and I was his commanding officer, I'd say, get in here. I want to talk to you. You can't even talk about looking at a picture without saying that you're too shaken up. You needn't be in the Navy. Just find another line of work. And by the way, if you're in the United States Navy, You might know that the United States Navy has pulled along coasts all over the world and blasted the bejesus out of people. I don't know if you ever saw the pictures, but if pictures bother you, if you've ever heard of Vietnam, Agent Orange, if you heard of the Iraq War, when the defense minister, the defense, whatever he is, they used to call him the Secretary of War, but after World War II, they changed that, the Secretary of Defense. But he said what we were going to deliver to Iraq was shock and awe. In other words, you're going to blast them so badly that they're just going to be like with their mouths hanging open. And they did that. And then when they arrived, they went through a process that ended up with setting up a place called Abu Ghraib. I don't know if John Kirby, the Rear Admiral, has seen those pictures. They're kind of sickening. And it would be appropriate if he said how he felt about those pictures, because the women and men in the U.S. military who had leashes, dog leashes around the necks of naked men, dragging them around, making them pile up in bodies of naked men for pictures, putting a guy who had to stand on a box with his head covered and electrodes in his private places. I don't know if Mr. Kirby could take that. I suspect he actually could. He probably thinks that now that he would think is a Broadway musical. But that's all this to underline, we're led by a pack of ignoramuses. We probably all think, well, that's just, those guys are just fronting. There's probably somebody who knows what he's doing in the back room. I'm sorry, I can't confirm that. Therefore, we're stuck with an ignorant parliament, and America's represented by a dimwit rear admiral. And then we have Nancy Pelosi, who's taking cookies to Mr. Zelensky in Ukraine. Of course, the Pentagon is shipping weapons, but she showed up to say how we're in solidarity. I don't get it. I don't understand why Zelensky, he must occasionally think, maybe I should just vacate this place. All they need is somebody cardboard, because in fact, all the agony is on the part of the Ukrainian people without anybody indicating there's any sign of an exit. When the Star says, maybe we should find a way to, they didn't use the word de-escalate, but back up from the brink. I'll take that, back up from the brink. They say we should do that, back up from the brink. Nancy Pelosi isn't doing that. She's saying, well, we're with you to the end. If I was him, I'd say, we? What are you talking about? I'm the one who's here. And you just came to visit. I understand you're leaving, by the way, shortly. You're not staying for dinner? You can't stick around? Maybe tomorrow we could play golf? You, number one congresswoman, nice to see you. So you're with us till the end. I wish the Ukrainian people had time out here for a referendum on their leadership and could actually make some choices. But I'd have to remind you, Mr. Zelensky banned 11 parties that were, they supported the war. They condemned Russia. They banned them anyway. And then his old rival, Mr. Poroshenko, as far as I know, is still accused of treason, even while he's supposedly part of the Patriotic Front. I saw former boxing champ Klitschko, now the mayor of Kyiv. His main home is in Berlin. I mean, that's not a metaphor. His home is in Berlin. His fortune's there. He earned it. He fought people to give him that. But they're in a, this is a mess. and we don't have anything resembling leadership. So I probably had a few more things to say about this. This is the Tater Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. Take a little break, come back. I'm going to talk a bit with Tony Leah of Unifor. We want to know what's going on in Jerryland. And we are back, just as I threatened. This is the Tater Report, CIUT. I'm Phil Tater, your host. And we were speaking to Tony Leah about labor and about May Day, and it put me in mind of the book that we did an interview about last week on the show, which was Fox Hunt. And the author is Luke Barron. As you will remember Luke as not only a great author, and I do recommend the novel Fox Hunt. He's also a fight fan, which puts him gives him a special place in my mind, because I grew up with boxing. His book, Fox Hunt, talks about a phenomena that contributed mightily to our inability in North America to properly recognize May Day, which is a holiday around the world. There are many countries in the world with terrible reputations that celebrate May Day, but Canada can't bring itself to do that. And the book Fox Hunt helps explain why. It's primarily in the cultural field where Luke Barron points out, and he treats it, it's a fictional treatment of something that happened. And as you will remember from the interview, that he's attempting to get in, you might say, in the heads of the people, writers, artists, theater people, movie people, but mainly in the field of literature. It gathered around a magazine in Britain called Encounter. One of the magazines in the United States that I remember very well was Reporter magazine. And Gore Vidal, for example, Isaac Deutscher published in them. And they were interesting, of course. But behind it was CIA money, and not only money, honchos, bosses, who wanted, you know, they were sort of, they were into quantity, weighing what percentage of your material helped us in the great cause, being the anti-communism. That was the target of the day. And Fox Hunt discusses that very, very well. And so this is partly an apology to Luke Barron that I didn't take him into this other area. And I promise to do that in the future. He's an affable fellow, and I think we'd be happy to talk more about this. But in the field of labor, CIA was also very, very busy. And they provided money and direction, and they had the same smart spiel that they had. They recruited people who had been part of the socialist movement, but particularly people who had been communists. And as we mentioned several names last week amongst writers and others, Arthur Koestler would be a good example. A sad story would be Richard Wright. Others who contributed to a book called The God That Failed, which was a hoax book if there ever was one. But people put this together. They had a political agenda, of course. The game was to use former communists as sort of the best witness. They'd say, you know, the reason you got to really be against him is this guy, he'll tell you because he was a member. He was one of them. And then he, you know, was sort of like a performing rat, and he would get up and do a little spiel. The element that I think I've, in my own following of this matter, that I've underestimated over the years is just flat out money. Money. People made a lot of money. As one of the characters in the novel by Luke Barron, an anarchist woman from Montreal, she said, "Where does all this money come from?" She's an artist. She's a poet. and a free spirit, you might say. But she had 20/20 vision, and she knew that nothing she'd ever done ever paid, you know, anything. But all of a sudden, somebody said they really think she's marvelous, and they wanted to come to conferences and give speeches about her poetry, but also saying that the reason she writes her poetry is because she wants to fight communism, you know, that kind of stuff. And as she began this, as the word is, smell a rat, which leads to the downfall of the conscience and the brain, almost the melting of the brain of the character, the lead character, a Canadian novelist named Milne, is it Milne Lowell or Lowell Milne? Anyway, yeah, Milne Lowell. The American Lowell was caught up in all this, the poet. But he has a, he begins to recognize too that maybe it's not his wonderful fiction that they're interested in, but the dirty work he's prepared to help them do. Them, CIA, they used to call them the company. But I want to move it over to labor again. Not that this is the beat of Mr. Bain, of Luc Béarn, but it was run by the same gang. That is to say, CIA, which is now the national, what they call it, National Endowment for Democracy. The Endowment for Democracy. They had, and my point is about money and making sure that they got people who could have credentials as former radicals, communists. And they found their man in Jay Lovestone. And you really ought to look at the career of Jay Lovestone. And I have over the years been, you know, been interested in the terrible role he played, because they had him front organizations with his credentials, that he had once been a founder member of the American Communist Party, and had led a faction. They were called the Lovestoneites, or if you were in New York, IS. You can be an ite or an ist. If you're an ite, you get punched in the mouth. If you say it. Anyway, Jay Lovestone, he set up organizations for the CIA, not just in the United States, to drive out, and destroy not only the communists, but any progressive union itself. He worked very hard, and he had a partner. I don't want to say he did all this himself, who also had the same type of credentials. The factor I had, I think, underestimated, but I was looking in because of, inspired by the novel Fox Hunt, I thought, I'm going to look at this again. And I noticed that he was paid a lot of money. It was long ago, and he was making like $1 million per, and raising holy havoc. His group went into Italy and worked with the fascists, the right wing in Italy, to try to bust up the Italian labor movement. They did a lot of damage. I'm not saying it's irreparable, or that they were entirely successful, but that was all going on. They did it, of course, in the United States and Canada. Canadian Seamen's Union was destroyed with CIA money and State Department, and Diefenbaker was involved. And the Seamen's Union was busted up, and to make sure they had the right guy, and the Mine Mill and Smelter Workers Union. It's a fact. If you read Mick Lowe, published by Baraka Books, I think it was the first of his trilogy. They might have called it Nickel something trilogy. What he had at the end of the novel was an actual document that he just put into the novel, where leaders were talking about what they had been doing and who was running things. And it was said at a meeting right here in Toronto that CIA was calling the shots. And, you know, many people doubted that at the time, or found ways to say they didn't agree, and probably they thought it was something else. But in fact, it was a CIA operation. But, and in case of Lovestone, the idea that he was some sort of principled guy who had a great believer in proletarian internationalism and struggle for socialism, but had been badly treated by the evil Stalinist Reds, etc., actually was a rat who took a lot of money and did a lot of damage. It's a period that needs to be revisited. And Fox Hunt's a good place to start. Luke Bairn, Fox Hunt. We're going to have to talk about this again more in the future. Because I'll just say it as simply as I can, abstract expressionism was invested in and promoted, not to say maybe created, by Western intelligence, that is the CIA. They wanted to get rid of realist art, get rid of it. The game was to say it's dated, et cetera, and of course it's the kind of thing that socialists like, whereas actually the American people, when they saw abstract art, they said the same thing that Khrushchev said, which is, hey, I could do that with the tail of a donkey. And they say, oh, no, this, are you kidding? This is great art. It really bothers me that Jackson Pollock, the king of abstract expression, I guess, in the U.S., I probably got the wrong term, said, I hope a bunch of people who write 800 pages books on these things don't come over and poke me with their pens. But I do know, and I'm going to leave this as a mystery story on a Taylor report. I do know that Jackson Pollock began as a realist painter, a good one, studying under an individual whose name escapes me, who was one of the great American painters. His career came to an end, not because he was a Red, by the way. He was not, but he was a realist. It is variations on it, and I'm not going to pretend I can do them all. Obviously, there are variations in any style of art. That individual painted some of the most memorable murals that have ever been painted. And he came from very interesting stock. He was from Missouri, where his family had produced governors and senators, but he's probably the most remembered, although Phil Taylor at the moment cannot remember his name. I'm going to tell you his name later in the next show. You donate and I'll tell you the name. Anyway, Jackson Pollock was his student, and the two fell out over this stuff. But the point here is that you not only were the CIA promoting, you know, like this, here's a liberal democracy, this is freedom of the type you should emulate and want to be and all that. It involved destroying artists, destroying novelists, destroying theaters, wiping them out. Because it wasn't just that our guy is going to be the best, that we're going to make sure that the guy who has our party line, which is the NATO liberal line, our guy is going to be on the cover of every magazine and people are going to say he's a genius and touch his feet. Not just going to be that. We're going to kill off the guys who are more talented than he is or she is. We're going to make sure that we get him. He's going to be our axe to chop down the giants. That's what it was. And it's captured pretty good in Fox Hunt. Fox Hunt's a good place to begin on that. Now, this is the Taylor Report, 89.5 FM. Next Monday, the 9th, we're going to be launching our spring campaign to the fundraising for the station and your opportunity to donate. And I'm going to point out to you, you don't have to wait around. You can donate anytime you like. The only proviso I add to that is I hope you will mention the Taylor Report. Going back to the beginning of our show and the danger of war, I want to mention that the situation, a place maybe we should begin, maybe we could, may be the moment for us, is this little war crisis going on at the place called Azovstal. It looks like Stelco, and it is in Mariupol. And beneath the floors of the factory, steel mill, whatever it is are maybe 1,000 armed members of the Azov Brigade, together with we don't know how many civilians. But we do know that for the first time since this fighting began that I'm aware of, is that the United Nations and the Red Cross, and I really always like to stop and take my hat off to the Red Cross, because there's so many people claim to be humanitarian, and most of them are hacks and hustlers. But the Red Cross has held up very well over time, and they do know how to manage dangerous situations. This is a dangerous one. I will talk to you in military terms. The Russians have actually captured Mariupol. Western media doesn't want to say that because it goes against the storyline that they've already got. Their little chalkboard is already drawn up, and so they got a little problem. But it's basically Mariupol has been captured, whether you like it or not, yay or nay, it's captured. However, there is this group. It is part of the National Guard of the Ukraine. It is a distinctly right wing. It is not disputed, that its leadership has an ideology that is frankly neo-Nazi. That's just happens to be who they are. And everyone says that they're very dedicated and they're willing to fight. The Star and the others, CBC, like to say, they're fighting there. They're actually not doing that. They are hunkered down. And the matter has to be resolved, preferably without any further loss of life. Speaking just from a military problem, it's bad that forces that are in these kind of circumstances have leadership that knows that, considers things coldly and objectively, and makes a decision that will save those armed fighters, more importantly, the civilians. They say there might be 1,000 there, but the Red Cross and UN are there, and they are actually able, through cooperation with what they call the parties, the parties being the government of Ukraine and government of Russia. This should have happened before, but it is happening now. But it seems to be, it's not smooth. Approximately 100, maybe 200 people have been removed. There's so much politics around this. Red Cross is cautioning everybody to reduce the attempt to turn this into a political occasion. Everybody should go by the agreed rules to bring this violent matter to an end with a reducing the loss of life. But there are many people around who have to, you know, want to be crowing, or they don't want to be shamed. That's what the Red Cross is, very sensitive to people not wishing to be exposed and into a bind. So let us hope that that philosophy will go forward. But also, there should be no talk about, oh, this is like the Alamo, Custer. I don't know what they think there anybody might want to have happen there. And it would behoove the helpful and to stop making noises which are insulting and ignorant. You're not a big player. You're under NATO's umbrella. You're one of the umbrella guys. You don't have a nuclear weapon. You would never be allowed to have one, even if you wanted it. So you act like a regular state and speak carefully. And don't be talking about how you're going to empty the treasury in Canada and have somebody else somewhere long way from here die with your weapons if they ever get there. So we need less of that nonsense. What we need is to see that we're build on the cooperation that took that is taking place. The sticking point is going to be, no doubt in my mind, when it turns into the issue of what about the fighters? I read in the Star and everywhere else that, well, you know, civilians are going to get out and they're going to go to the Ukrainian side. And why shouldn't the fighters? Well, I'm sorry, but it's like a game. You have a uniform and you said you wanted to be, and you carried a weapon. So the guy who you were carrying the weapon against just happens to have you behind the eight ball. And you don't get to take time out and say, now I'm a civilian. He might, if he wishes, or they wish, turn you into a neutral, but you're not a neutral. As far as I know, these are people who wanted to fight. So their commander, and I guess I'll end with a big question, is he actually the leader, Mr. Zelensky? I want to know. I haven't heard from him. Does he want them to, will he give them permission to surrender? There have been many famous leaders in history. You can read about them, who said to their soldiers, fight to the last man. I wouldn't want to wear that hat myself. Seems to me that the great generals have said to somebody who's kept in a corner, put your arms down, live to fight another day, but I'm not going to, why sacrifice? There's nothing in this situation, nothing strategic to be gained. What do you know? Phil Taylor said, strategic? This is CIUT 89.5 FM. Next week, you're going to be donating. I look forward to it.